The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You heard the saying, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, that's kind of the point for a new collection of short stories called Murder, Inc., and that's I-N-K, 13 Tales of New England Newsroom Crime. Dan Chesney is an author, a seasoned journalist, and associate publisher of The Hippo. He's also editor of Murder, Inc., and Dan, great to finally have you on the program.
Oh, thanks for being here.
Oreste Darkonti is former publisher of The Sun Chronicle from Attleboro, Massachusetts, and a writer of pulp fiction. His story, One Way, Dead End, is just one of the tales in Murder, Inc. Oreste, I am told we can call you Rusty.
That is good.
Dan, this is a collection of pulpy stories
Yes.
about murders and deadlines and mean editors. And at the heart of these stories is the idea that the reporter is kind of obsessive, maybe a little unbalanced. Is that an observation from your long career in journalism?
More than a little unbalanced, yes. The whole idea behind this particular collection was that the line between the reporter and the detective is very, very thin. And the obsession of the hard-boiled detective is very similar to the obsession of the hard-boiled reporter. And sometimes you go over that line, and when you do go over that line, bad things tend to happen.
Yeah, but it must be really fun for reporters who have to, you know, meet deadlines, all about accuracy, fact-checking, to let their freak flag run free.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Doing fiction.
We knew right from the very beginning that we were that this collection was going to see the demise of several publishers, and we weren't disappointed.
Well, Oreste, your story has booze, murder, a heavy drinking protagonist, a dark sense of humor, smart and sexy dame, so sounds like a detective story to me.
Right. Sounds like my life, yeah.
Oh, really? Do you call everyone dames and skirts?
Not usually.
Well, I'd love to have you read a bit from your story to get a sense of the writing style.
Okay.
So you can set up the scene for us. This is at the Chuck, which the locals call the Upchuck.
Yes, yes. It's a sleazy bar. I should preface it by saying when I first started deciding I was going to write a novel of pulp fiction, I had no idea how to do it or where to start, but I knew it would begin in a sleazy bar that I had in mind. And so I did that and wrote on from then, had no idea where it was going, and ended up with three murders and an attempted murder near the end. So I'll just paint a little picture of this bar. Miller, who's the editor, he waved to Missy the barmaid, a jaded loser with tattoo teardrops on her cheek. She opened the Bud Light on the side of the cooler and put it in front of Miller. Nobody used a glass at the Chuck. Getting a clean one was like winning megabucks. I liked the Chuck because there was no jukebox and nobody talked. Everyone just sat there staring into their brown bottles or at the dark TV in the corner that had never worked, watching in their minds old black and white movies about the way they were. Oh, and I lived upstairs. I always said I ended up in the boroughs because I took a wrong turn off Interstate 95. After my marriage went sour, I just needed some space, that space being a desk at the Burroughs Beacon and a reserved stool at the Chuck.
Terrific.
Can you walk us through some of that language, that kind of hard-boiled detective language?
Well, I don't know. I guess it comes natural. I've been in the newspaper business probably about 40 years, so I've done just about everything, and did a lot of creative writing, feature stories, and stuff like that. I think you get used to that. Most of the outside creative writing I did prior to this was poetry, actually, and then I thought I'd take a hand at this, you know. And as I said, it. I was working on a novel. I was up to like 23,000 words when I found out about this anthology. And so I had to cut it down to 8,000. And of course, I'm an editor. I know how to do that, you know. And I boiled it down. It's probably a better story now. But it was three times as long.
Well, there's a funny part of your story where the main character, Randy, he has to do a little social media for a story that he's working on. I mean, otherwise you could be in 1956 or something like that. Do you find that that digital reality of today's reporter clashes with this smoky, noirish aesthetic?
Well, a little bit, but I think it's just part of the job now. It's pretty normal.
I was going to say, we have a story in here from Mark Arsenal. I believe it's from Mark Arsenal, where the the main three characters are just recently fired from a newspaper that's downsizing. That's a theme, by the way, in the collection as well. Yeah. And they sit around at a bar. And they're looking for dirt on this publisher who just fired them all. And what do? They all whip out their iPads and their cell phones to try to access the internet to get some information. So we're covering both sides of the digital age, I think. Although there is a story in here where we fight Nazis as well.
I did notice that. But it seems like there's a little bit of wistfulness of the good old days of, you know, gumshoe newspaper reporting. Did that become a recurring thing?
Yeah, I can't speak for Rusty. I can speak for myself. One of the challenges for me in getting all these stories and going through them and editing and then picking them out for the collection was that I felt a little wistfulness. You know, I'm not a reporter anymore. I was for 20 years. And it's a difficult, obsessive, takes all of your time, the money stinks kind of job. But man, it can be fun sometimes.
Oh, hey, I agree 100%. reporting is the best job. I'd like to go back to reporting now, even though I've been a publisher. I would love to be a reporter.
I'm talking about Murder, Inc. That's a collection of short stories that kind of take the style of noir pulp fiction and place it squarely in the newsrooms of New England. Stories of murders and bad editors and tough deadlines. And joining me is the editor, Dan Chesney, seasoned journalist in his own right, and Rusty Darconti. He's former publisher of the Sun Chronicle and one of the contributors to the collection. Well, both of you have done the newspaper gig, but done other types of writing as well. So how did newsrooms prepare you for writing for a wider audience, Dan?
I think newsrooms prepared me for all types of writing, streamlining, editing, making sure every word count, the inverted pyramid, the whole 10 yards for me, especially as in editing. You know, the irony, of course, of editing a collection of newsroom from reporters in New England, most of whom I knew, a lot of whom I'm friends with, was that I had to be a good editor. I had to use my newsroom skills in order to edit the stories and make sure that, you know, I still remained friends with them.
So. You just hit on something, the camaraderie, the sort of camaraderie of the journalists.
Oh, yeah.
How does that play?
Yeah, I imagine it's probably the same with cops and with firemen and with detectives and that whole, after a tough day, you get together at the end of the day. And there's a lot of that fictionalized in the story. At the end of the day, you get together and you just blow off steam. In Rusty's case, it's, you know, his character is blowing off steam in a bar. But there's a lot of bars in this book. So I think, you know, in order you get around and you kibitz and you complain about your editors, you complain about your publishers. I think when you're in an industry where you have to work that hard, oftentimes for that little payback, at the end of the day, you just want to get together and kind of release.
So that hard drinking model we have of the reporter on deadline with the scotch in the lower third drawer, true?
Well, I have to say that at one time it was not that uncommon to find a bottle of whiskey in a drawer, but not anymore. You never see that anymore today.
They're not smoking in newsrooms either.
No, they're not doing that either.
I think they get together at the Starbucks now.
Yeah.
So are we going to assume that there's a lot more accuracy in sourcing in all of these hard-boiled Murder, Inc. stories?
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these stories come in part from real experiences, yes.
Plaid Swede, which is the publisher of other short story collections along with Murder, Inc. Previously, all the other books are about New Hampshire. There's Live Free or Undead, a book of horror stories, Love Free or Die, Granite State romance stories. So, Dan, what's behind this choice to broaden the scope with Murder, Inc. and include stories from all over the region?
Yeah, well, George Gears himself, and in fact, was George your boss at one point? Or were
no,
you
he
his
wasn't.
Boss?
No, but I'm a good friend of George.
Is that the publisher?
Yeah, that's the publisher. George actually knew... There's a lot of stories in here where editors and publishers with the name George meet their untimely ends, and that's not a surprise either, because George is well known around New England media, around the New England newsroom. So when him and I sat down to plot this out, Originally, we wanted to keep it with the New Hampshire theme. But the more we talked about it and the more we looked at his and my experiences in New England, the more we thought that we could actually reach out and make this more of a regional book. There's so many reporters and editors and former publishers out there who have these great stories. So why not make it a big deal? Plus, we had the opportunity to release the book at the newspaper convention down in Boston, which is where we had our big release party, and which is where the release party for Volume 2 will be next year as well. So we wanted to jump at that chance.
So George, as often as he's been bumped off, he's going to publish another collection
for you.
He's
going to continue to be bumped off some more, yes.
Oreste, do you think there's something about New England that lends itself to these kind of pulpy stories? I don't know, the character, the places, the taciturn nature, what?
Certainly New England has a lot of character, and you see that, you know, especially down by me in Attleboro, Mass. You know, the we got Lovecraft right over the border there. You know, you can see his grave. You can retrace his steps. In fact, they just had a Lovecraft walking tour. There's a lot of seamy places, a lot of old factory towns that have a lot of character and have a lot of characters in them.
What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, plus we're all right on top of each other, right? You know, I spent a lot of time in the Midwest, and there's space in between towns. But here, you leave one mill town and you enter another. So we all know each other, you know, and especially the newspaper biz. Everybody knows everybody in the newspaper biz. The space between Boston and Manchester is 45 minutes. That's, you know, a quarter of the way across Chicago, right? So New England has a unique place in sort of pulp literature. And genre fiction, and a lot of the guys like Damian Runyon and Dashiell Hammett spent time in Boston. I think it's pretty clear and pretty obvious why a series of short stories about murderous newspaper rooms would be birthed in New England.
Oreste D'Arcante, former publisher of the Sun Chronicle in Attleboro, Mass., and a contributor to Murder, Inc., thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
And Dan Chesney, he's associate publisher of The Hippo, editor of Murder, Inc., 13 Tales of New England Newsroom Crime. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dan Oreste and five of their other contributing writers from the collection are going to be reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord this Saturday. That's March 26th at 4 o'clock. They'll be up in North Conway at the Book Warehouse on April 22nd. You can find details at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Maybe you've noticed a kind of dark motif running through Word of Mouth today. So far, we've heard about a collection of hard-boiled crime stories written by New England newshounds. And later in the show, we're going to hear about a lurid real-life murder that shocked the citizens of New Hampshire and the region. But first, we're going to look back to a shadowy genre of cinema that originated in the 1940s and 50s, film noir. This piece, examining its history, comes to us from producer Sarah Fischko and the Fischko Files.
Sometimes you don't know what you're doing until after you've done it. Writers and directors in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s didn't exactly know they were making films that would later be seen as connected by era, content, and style.
It was on a side road outside of Los Angeles.
And then given a name.
I was hitchhiking from San Francisco down to
film noir.
San Diego, I guess.
Every interview I've ever done with anybody involved in the making of these films said we had no idea what, you know, still don't know what film noir is. We were just making crime dramas.
They are dangerous and armed. Shoot to kill.
Eddie Muller is the author of Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. He's had a lifelong obsession with these movies, made in those uneasy years during and after the Second World War, and then named by the French.
There was an embargo on Hollywood product in Europe during World War II. So it wasn't until after the war that these French cinemas began showing retrospectives of everything that the French had missed during World War II. And that is the point at which several critics made the observation that, you know, what's happened in Hollywood, all of a sudden, you know, the films have gone black. Why this sudden darkness and this bitterness?
We go together, Laurie. I don't know why. Maybe like guns and ammunition go together.
I'll do anything you want.
Many of them had been made by Europeans who'd fled Nazi Germany and come to Hollywood. They set about adapting crime novels by writers like Raymond Chandler and James M. Cain. Check. And they had a certain attitude.
You thought you had a cold, didn't you? All wrapped up in tissue paper with pink ribbons around it.
I sort of distill it down into the idea of, you know it's wrong, you do it anyway, and now you can't escape.
You want to know who killed Dietrichson? Hold tight to that cheap cigar of yours, Keyes. I killed Dietrichson.
There is certainly no escape in Double Indemnity, in which an insurance salesman follows his fetching customer down the road to murder. The ultimate noir, people drowning in greed and lust.
As he says in that movie, I did it for the money, and I did it for a woman. And I didn't get the money, and I didn't get the woman.
I didn't get the money, and I didn't get the woman. Pretty, isn't it?
I did it for a woman, and I did it for the money, and I didn't get the woman, and I didn't get the money.
Karen Hollinger likes that line, too. She's the author of In the Company of Women. Years ago, she became interested in the way noir films look at men and women.
Is there anything I can do?
The insurance ran out on the 15th. I'd hate to think of you having a smashed fender or something while you're not fully covered.
This bantering back and forth between them.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
And there's this sense of, well, who's going to win? Both of them trying to sort of have the upper hand.
Although in most noir films, it's pretty clear who has the upper hand.
I went to Pablo's that night. I knew I'd go every night until she showed up. I knew she knew it.
The female character, the femme fatale, has much greater visual significance than anyone else in the film.
And then she walked in out of the moonlight, smiling.
She stands out. Camera follows her. Camera looks at her legs. Camera is fascinated by her, as the narrator is. She draws the attention visually, whereas the voiceover is attempting to draw the attention to the male narrator. And the viewer, it seems to me,
is
sort of caught in the middle.
Voiceover is a film noir staple.
As I drove off, it was still raining, and the drops streaked down the windshield like tears.
What else characterizes noir's sound?
Look who's here.
What's the sound of people smoking? I saw Out of the Past again the other day. I showed it for an audience, and it was unbelievable how much smoking goes on in that film.
Cigarette?
Smoking.
That's the sound of noir. It's men and women smoking. And ice cubes tinkling in a glass, and tires on wet pavement, and the rustling of curtains and gowns, and guns being loaded. Not necessarily fired, but guns being loaded.
And, of course, often they were fired.
The sound of rapid-fire dialogue.
My right hand hasn't seen my left hand in 30 years.
I'll do it, J.J. Don't get me wrong. In for a penny, in for a pound, I'll go through with it.
It's a curious thing that these brittle, cynical films that came out of the Hollywood studios, for the most part, reached us the way they did, and still do, considering their modest beginnings.
Noir films kind of started out as B-movies, and nobody paid much attention to them.
Director Jim McBride.
But you feel in these films there's somebody speaking behind them.
It's that post-war voice, both tormented and true to itself.
The voice they spoke in was a very personal voice, and it was a very clear voice, and one that you could clearly understand and to.
There have been films made in that tradition, neo-noir, post-noir, semi-noir, noir-ish. But what happened to the real noir films made in that period? Eddie Muller, who, by the way, calls himself the czar of noir, has his theory, which is that Hitchcock ended it all.
That's where a crime thriller suddenly veers off and becomes a horror film. The subtlety of the classic film noir era sort of went down the drain when Janet Leigh is killed in Psycho, and a whole new type of sensational cinema comes into vogue. To me, Psycho is the pivot point in American cinema. You can actually have this horrible murder in the film, and there's, you know, transvestitism in the film and matricide. There was no going back.
Mother! Oh, God! Mother! Blood! Blood!
So yes, by that logic, it is gone forever. And even imitations can't be quite the same because of what we've seen since. But these are movies, after all, so we can look at them forever. The shiny nighttime streets, the curling smoke, And those characters, they're part of us. Mildred Pierce, Walter Neff, Sidney, J.J., Frank Chambers, Waldo Leidecker, and all the rest. Proper companions as we make our way through the dark modern world, no? From the Fishko Files, I'm Sarah Fishko.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On the evening of October 9th, 2012, 19-year-old UNH student Lizzie Marriott left her home in Chester, New Hampshire, to meet up with a coworker in Dover. She was never seen again. For the next 2 years, the tragic circumstances of Lizzie's disappearance dominated the headlines, and details of the case rocked the seacoast.
It was inevitable that Seth Mazzaglia was going to kill.
The defendant and McDonough schemed about how they could exploit her sexually.
And Lizzie Marriott was the perfect victim for him.
Kevin Flynn and Rebecca Lavoie wrote about the Seth Mazzaglia case in Dark Heart, a true story of sex manipulation and murder. Rebecca is also NHPR's digital director. And Rebecca, thanks for coming all this way.
Thank you, Virginia.
And Kevin Flynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
So refresh our memories. What were Seth Mazzaglia and Catherine McDonough charged with, and what were their respective sentences?
Seth Mazzaglia was charged with first-degree murder. He's alleged to have lured Lizzie Marriott with the help of his girlfriend, Kat McDonough, to his apartment in Dover. They allegedly had designs on convincing Lizzie to join them in a three-way sexual liaison. And when that didn't go as planned, the state says that Seth strangled Lizzie. When he was put on trial, Seth's defense was that Lizzie died during a consensual sex act. And it basically became a he said, she said, because Lizzie's body was never recovered.
And how about Kat McDonough, the girlfriend? What was she charged with?
Well, she got what many people considered a sweetheart deal. She was charged with obstruction of justice and some other minor charges, but they were able to leverage that into her testimony against Seth Mazzaglia. But, you know, when you look at it, really, Kat held all the cards because, again, it was a he said, she said.
And what's interesting is that in the state of New Hampshire, and what a lot of people didn't know, especially people who are watching the case from outside the state, which a lot of people were because it was a sensational trial and Lizzie Marriott was from Massachusetts, is there is no accessory after the fact law in New Hampshire. So even though Kat McDonough admitted that she helped Seth get rid of Lizzie Marriott's body in the Piscataqua River, that's not actually a crime to know somebody that committed a murder, to not report it, and then also to do something to the body. She cannot be charged with murder if the state indeed thinks that she didn't actually commit the act.
Now, you two have written together on several true crime novels about especially local cases. What was it about this case that interested you?
This one in particular was interesting to me because it was less about Seth Mazzaglia and what he was accused of, and more about his girlfriend, Kat McDonough, who, by all accounts, when she met Seth, was a very normal, you know, well-liked 17-year-old theater girl that was bubbly and vivacious and had friends and had a normal high school student's life. And within a year and a half, she was pushing the body of her friend into the water. And what was that evolution? How does that look when you have somebody who takes that turn in their life?
What was also compelling as a story was there were details that came out about their sex life, a very extreme form of BDSM, mm-hmm. way beyond what many people are familiar with in 50 Shades of Grey. And there was also this other kind of fantasy life in which Seth convinced Kat that they had lived past lives together, that currently there are other personas that they had in this place beyond the veil of existence, and that those characters were affecting things in the real world. And that was part of the manipulation that that she alleged and that the state alleged was how Seth was able to control Kat.
In fact, the name Dark Heart, the name of the book, is one of his aliases. They both had several different sort of characters that they took on in this fantasy world. But neither Kat nor Seth would talk to you for the book, but you were able to really reconstruct their relationship using Facebook messaging largely, which confused me because with everything that's going on, the fight between Apple and the FBI over access to data, this was public record at that point, or
It was. And sometimes when we talk about, you know, people in conversation will say, well, you know, will you write about me if I do something horrible? The joke is, well, keep a diary. And in a way, they actually did keep a diary in that they were able to recover all of the instant messaging between the two of them as they're beginning their relationship. This is important because at the time, Kat McDonough is 17 years old. And mom and dad won't let her go out and date a guy who is in his late 20s. So the most of their communication is electronic, and it gives you an unprecedented view of how the relationship begins and evolves, and you can read the manipulation that happens. As adults looking back, while we read it, it was very clear to us what he was doing. If you're a 17-year-old, it's a little more oblique.
The other thing that's really interesting is that there was more there than I think would have been there in a typical relationship, because Seth, I've really come to believe, whatever his personality disorder is, and there's some debate about this, whether or not he's a narcissist, whether or not he's a sexual sadist, whether or not he has some sort of real personality disorder present, he has a need to basically relive every experience he has later in writing. So unlike other books we've written where the only way we're able to include dialogue is if we interview somebody and ask them what they said, he would say to her what he had said that day on their date, or, you know, they would basically rewrite the whole scene and relive it together in these late night Facebook messages and basically provide us with a complete picture of all of their interactions.
That must really change the game for true crime writers. I mean, we've heard, of course, of Truman Capote sitting there, you know, talking with those charged in the Clutter murders, you know, just eerie stuff. You're combing through this. What's that like?
Well, you know, in the past, we've had varying degrees of cooperation from the accused. I mean, Rebecca's spent a lot of time at the men's prison, probably more so than we'd like
doing
to admit.
Doing interviews.
And, you know, one of the major reasons that Seth and Kat, I'm assuming, did not participate is they're still in legal jeopardy at this point. Seth has an appeal, so it isn't in his best interest, obviously, to talk to some writers. And when it comes to the victim, in this case, Lizzie Marriott, I mean, there's no way to go back and interview them. However, because it's 2016, she left a large digital footprint through social media. So in addition to what people who knew about Lizzie contributed, we were able to get Lizzie in a lot of her own words and her own voice because of the way that she talked about her days on Facebook. And it was actually, you know, probably the best source, you know, first person of a murder victim that we've ever had.
And it took the least toll, I think. I think that, you know, we heard Sarah Koenig talking, I think, on the New Yorker Radio Hour about her.
This is the host of the Serial podcast.
The host of Serial, about how her relationship with Adnan Syed when she was taping season one was in some ways very gratifying as a journalist and in other ways very challenging, because you do have then a person who's incarcerated for a crime that they may or may not have committed, and you're really attached to them for long stretches of time. And when I've previously done in-prison interviews with somebody who had been convicted of a murder for one of our previous books, I can tell you it really does take a toll. Going to the prison takes a toll. Having to think about what you wear to prison takes a toll. Having to sit with somebody whom you know is leaving the table and going back to a cell and forming a relationship with them takes a toll. And I'm not saying that this is better necessarily, but it was certainly easier from the psychic standpoint, I think, as someone who writes a book like this.
We're talking about a 2012 murder case here in New Hampshire that grabbed a lot of headlines, captivated a lot of people. About Lizzie Marriott was the young woman who was murdered. It's a pretty grisly case. And Kevin Flynn and Rebecca Lavoie are with us. They are true crime writers and have written the story called Dark Heart, a true story of sex manipulation and murder. Well, Rebecca, I want to go back to that point of sort of coming to know a murderer. Now, you know the Netflix documentary, of course, Making a Murderer, mm-hmm. that a lot of people were captivated by just around Christmas time. And, you know, the filmmakers, the pair of them, got a lot of criticism for
eliminating parts of the story, for only telling a certain part of the story, because they bought into the defense, I think, of the man who was charged with murder and his nephew. So how do you, I mean, you're working together. How do you sort of check each other to make sure that you're representing all sides of a story?
Well, two things. One is whenever you write, you should try to keep it maybe encapsulate it, but keep it accurate and without distortion. Someone said, you know, that it should be like drawing a map. You on the map, you wouldn't have the mountain in full size, but on the map it should be here's the mountain and here's the river and here's the relationship between them. So like all writers, you try to keep all of that in there and just condense it. And yeah, sometimes there are things where you have to make a determination that this interview with this other person isn't as important to the narrative arc as this interview is. So you sometimes make those decisions. And, you know, one of the most compelling parts of the whole story is Kat McDonough herself, because she was the state's star witness. But unlike any trial that we can remember, the question of her ultimate culpability, her honesty on the stand was questioned openly in on social media.
Yeah, I remember
and in
that.
The news
she didn't
coverage.
Cry. She said, I was crying, but there were no tears. I
right,
remember
right.
That.
I can't remember a trial where basically people were suspicious of the state's star witness. Now, this had nothing to do with whether or not people thought Seth was guilty. This was a sort of independent, and this was where the argument came in. Do you believe Kat or do you not believe her?
Well, Kat does really come off as, well, let's say Seth comes off as this kind of sadistic Svengali, you know, who sort of lures in this young woman. So we get a somewhat sympathetic picture of her, I think. But this is the woman who, you know, as you mentioned, pushed the body of her dead friend into the Piscataqua River. And her sentence was pretty light because of a plea deal. How did Lizzie's family feel about that?
They were not happy, obviously. You know, they they definitely felt like the laws in New Hampshire let them down because, as Rebecca said there, in this case, there wasn't really a lot that they could charge Kat with based on, you know, what they understood the circumstances of the incident to be. So they were, you know, very disappointed that to the length that she was not just legally culpable but sort of morally culpable, that she couldn't be held fully accountable. However, at the end, there was some sort of ambivalence because the family did recognize that without Kat's cooperation with authorities, it would be very hard to get a conviction against Seth. And I think there was a quote from Lizzie's dad that, you know, said, if it were not for Seth Mazzaglia, what happened to Kat McDonough would not have happened.
Mm. I don't want to put words in Lizzie's father's mouth either specifically. However, when we did correspond with him, he didn't cooperate for the book fully, but we did have some correspondence with him. And the thing that he said to us was that it was very important to him that we highlight the pattern of domestic abuse in this story, which to me tells me that he understands that Kat was also a victim, you know, at least on some level in this story.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating case, and I thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. I actually came in. Rebecca was already here.
Thanks, Virginia.
Kevin Flynn and Rebecca Lavoie, co-authors of Dark Heart, A True Story of Sex Manipulation and Murder. They're also co-hosts of the podcast Crime Writers On. You'll find a link to both on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've spoken to a number of writers today, but mostly we've talked about, well, murder. There are a few murders in The Queen of the Night. That's one of the year's most anticipated novels, but they serve a plot that is intentionally over the top, reflecting the improbably tragic, melodramatic grand operas of old, like the aria from Mozart's The Magic Flute that gives the novel its name. Alexander Chi is the author who dreamed it all up, and he joined us for our 10-Minute Writers Workshop series and podcast to share the unglamorous process of getting that elegant novel onto the page.
I'm Alexander Chi, and this is the 10-Minute Writers Workshop.
Alexander Chi, thrilled to speak with you, and wondering for you, who took, I believe, 15 years to write this book, which do you think is harder to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
Maybe all of the ones in between. The first sentences came very quickly, actually, and it wasn't, it was 15 years between books, but the whole time wasn't spent entirely on this book. I did put it aside for, I would say, 3 or 4 years. What turned out to be part of the writing was finding the first sentence for the novel. The first sentences that you write aren't necessarily the first sentences of the novel. And then, of course, like choosing the last sentence also has this incredible power to it, but then there's so much revision that happens after that.
Do you edit as you go along, or do you wait to the end?
In the writing of this, I definitely edited as I went along. I think, in retrospect, that is a mistake. I think that it's better to write an entire draft, edit it, and then revise from there, and to retype. But I think when you're putting the first draft together, I think it's actually pretty important to just push on through until you have an ending and then figure out what is inside the draft and work from there.
That sounds like a good lesson. Are there other personal lessons or habits that you'd encourage other writers to take up or maybe even avoid to be more productive?
Sure. I had a number of habits and methods that I came up with in the writing of this. One was changing the font on a draft before I printed it up, and the point size and the spacing, so that it looked like something else entirely. There were often times when I would do that, and it was suddenly, you know, made strange to me again, and I was able to see things that were wrong that I had allowed to stay because they were only familiar.
Well, for a book like this of historical fiction, guessing you had to do a lot of research. Did you do that a lot before the start or throughout?
I did a lot of research after the beginning. And in a way, I realized I was writing the novel more than I set out to write the novel. You know, I think that pushing into a novel with your conscious mind where you decide you're going to write it, I think is a little bit of a folly, at least for me. You know, the ideas that I have are ideas that I come down with almost like a sickness. and then the writing of it is the cure.
So what is your personal worst distraction from writing or getting your work done?
Imagining failure. It's, as I tell my students, you can do two things with your imagination. You'll create two narratives. One will be the one that you can publish, and the other is a private narrative in which you are a failure. And both are incredibly vivid, but only one can take you forward. I do have I would say I have an unhappy relationship to email. I think, you know, my friend John Freeman, he wrote a really wonderful book about it called, if I'm remembering this correctly, The Tyranny of Email, where he calls it the to-do list that you don't choose, you know, where it's just stuff coming in and people needing things from you. And, you know, people have gotten less and less patient with the idea that it might take you any time at all to respond to them. I hate this idea of red receipts, you know, because it starts putting a clock on something that I might like to think about before I reply. Those are some things that I don't like, because I do have a part of me, you know, I'm the oldest brother, so I have this kind of like look out for your younger brother, younger sister sort of approach to my life, where I'm always worried that if I don't help this person, something terrible will happen. But it's an illusion left over from being held accountable anytime my siblings got in trouble.
How many times were you actually rejected before getting published?
Well, I mean, this will sound obnoxious, but the first story I ever sent out was accepted. So the answer is exactly once, I
suppose. That's encouraging. That's wonderful to hear.
It is. I actually had a kind of early success as a writer before I tried to publish Edinburgh that in retrospect was unrealistic. Edinburgh was rejected 24 times and accepted the 25th. And so I really had to learn that stamina.
So what do you think is the most common mistake that new writers make? Is it imagining that failure?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it really is the other side of the blade. You have to trust your idea. And if you don't trust the idea, then you have to consider giving it up, or you have to ask yourself, why don't I trust it? What don't I trust about this? You know, sometimes the ideas I see my students have for their work, they say things like, well, I don't want to write a novel. They can choose. And I think, well, if the idea is a novel, then your only obligation is to make it a novel whether you want to write one or not. Otherwise, you should just go work on something else.
I'm wondering if the opposite of imagining failure, having a kind of grandiosity, is also a danger.
Oh, definitely. I think that, and also just a kind of ego-centered wish for the thing to be done. You know, that was also something I would punish myself with. Or, even worse, imagining someone like me but better at finishing the novel than me and what he would have done. You know, these are all these kinds of wicked shadows that we can cast up.
So is there anything that you'd recommend, like books or tools, to encourage people for writing?
Sure. I often send people to Edith Wharton's The Writing of Fiction, which I think is a fine, short, clear, sensible book written by a master at the art. She explains a lot of things that no one ever explained to me when I was studying fiction writing, and her breakdown of the ways of approaching novels and stories both is quite sensible. I really like Charles Baxter's Burning Down the House, a really fine collection of essays about the writing of fiction. I also highly recommend E.M. Forster's Aspects of the Novel. And Janet Frame, the New Zealand writer, she has a wonderful autobiography. It's very long. It's 3 volumes, so it's quite a commitment. But in it, she has a lot of writing process stuff that she talks about. And I learned a lot in there as well about the importance of doing things that seem very almost ridiculously simple, but, you know, like making a list of your characters and a list of the places in the novel and then putting those up where you can see them. So that if you get stuck, you can look at them and your imagination does a kind of multiplication across the items and something can be triggered and you keep working.
What for you is the best environment for writing?
I like wherever I can feel like no one knows how to get me. wherever I would feel just completely forgotten about, you know, is my favorite place. It could be a cafe where I'm not known at all, or a train. And I really also love hotels. Those kinds of environments where it's not a part of my normal life are places where I can encounter myself differently. And then that's usually very valuable for writing.
What's the best piece of advice on writing you ever received?
That's tough. I've had some really great advice. I think the advice that I pass on the most is probably that it is very hard to know what your life looks like to other people. And so when you write about it or when you borrow from it, you have to be very, very careful, because the thing that you are so sure means this may not mean that when it is read by someone else. And I think you need caution when you write autobiographical fiction, caution when you write an autobiographical essay.
If you weren't a writer, do you have another dream job?
Oceanographer.
Interesting.
Definitely. My dad's job. I would just want to, like, basically be on boats and diving and around sea creatures. And I think, you know, also the ocean is easily one of the most important environments that we have to take care of in the near future. It's in a state of emergency.
Alexander Chi, thank you.
Sure.
And that was Alexander Chi for our series and podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Thank you for spending some time with Word of Mouth. We like to think of the show as a break from the headlines and the big news of the day, a way to pull back and explore other aspects of our creativity and culture and the stories that bubble up to feed the news. Well, if that works for you, consider casting your vote for NHPR and for Word of Mouth in New Hampshire Magazine's annual Best of Poll. We fall under the Shops and Services category, and you can find the link there or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.